This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
My name is Jorge Mariscal. Thank you all for coming. I'm the director of the Chicano, Chicana, Latino, Latina Arts and Humanities Program. And I want to thank Aide Cervantes, who's right back here, who made this all happen, all the food and the room and everything else. I think I know everybody in the room, actually, but most of you know the story of the Chicano Moratorium, and, you know, we're not going to retell that. Like all education, our goal today is not only to teach you about that period, but to see what we can take away for today, right? What can we learn from them? Chole Alatorre just said something to us 10 minutes ago, right, to Jason and I. She quoted Bert Corona, who's a, you know, legendary organizer. And apparently Bert said, you know, you even learn from the devil if you can, not because he's the devil, but because he's old and he has lots of experience, right? So some of us here are devils, and we're old. Right? So please give these amazing folks a big applause. All right, so I had some ideas about what to ask them, but as organizers, they all said to me today that they would like to engage with the audience first so that you are brought in, right? So that they know what you need. This is like classic organizing, right? They don't come here and say, oh, we know what you need to hear. No, they want to hear what you want to hear. You see what I'm saying? So I'm going to turn it over to them, whoever wants to take the lead on that. Katarina or Rosalía?
Okay. Yes, we would just really like to hear a few of you define what are your challenges today. That you think we can be helpful in sharing our experience.
And also, if there's any, some of you or many of you may have been studied about the moratorium, the Chicano movement, and from then and even before. So if you have questions you'd like to ask, just what you're curious about, what you found out, what might be interesting, those kinds of things.
I'd like to add, if you have things or concerns or issues from what you see, what's been documented historically, how does it relate to today?
Levanten la mano cuántos hablan español. Ah, qué bueno. Okay. I want to try English because I don't know English, okay? But I try. What do you prefer to find out that can serve to you in the future? Because you started. Now we're almost going. So we have to hurry and prepare you guys or helping you to be prepared for the future. So asking all the questions you want in English and Spanish. If I don't understand or I cannot explain to you, we have a very good translators. So thank you very much to be here.
¿Cómo creen que podemos seguir avanzando la educación para que incluya más otro tipo de culturas como la mexicana, la latinoamericana, incluso la chicana? O sea, ¿qué creen que podemos hacer nosotros como estudiantes para hacer que eso pase en nuestro campus?
Well, shall we just jump right in, question by question? Okay, well, no, pase primero, Chole.
No.
Okay.
Bueno, lo primero que deben de hacer es tratar de pensar en sus amigos, en sus compañeros, en sus hermanos y en su familia. And get a little bit, aunque sea poquito, organizarse. Organizarse, no el levantar la basura de los trastes, o no quién va a lavar los trastes, sino en qué estamos haciendo y cómo estamos viviendo. Lo primero es pensar en estar organizados.
Well, exactly flowing from that. One thing I think that many of us learned when we started becoming active as students in the 60s, that there is no separation. And where there is, there should not be a separation between what happens in academia, at the schools at all levels, and what's happening in our communities. So, and I think what many of us as student activists found is there's a beautiful dynamic, a beautiful dialectic between the efforts of advocacy and consciousness between students and the community. Back and forth at all levels, which is why the struggle for good pro-working class education at all levels is so important. But you do have a unique opportunity at this level of education to have that dynamic between the community serve everyone.
I would urge that you go into the community. Charlie says go into your own family, the people closest to you, and also in community efforts. And, organizing, struggling for rights, just knowing a little bit of how the system works or where you go, other people may not be aware of, and you begin sharing with people. I know when I got out into the community out of college and even before graduating, people say, oh, you went to college, and they start asking you about a welfare problem, unemployment, this or that, and engage people on that. How do you solve that? Or find out where it is, because that's what organizing is, teaching people how to, from the struggles we had before, from what we know, and then sharing that with people, like in the moratorium. We found out, hey, we're dying at twice the rate. We found out the percentages and where, and then we shared that with everybody. And we don't think that's right. And people said, yeah, that's not right. So I'd like to start off the moratoriums. The first March, the media wasn't giving us much coverage. Blacks were getting some from Martin Luther King, of course, and Muhammad Ali refusing induction. While our people, Bert Corona and all others, T. Herina, Corky, they were all speaking Dolores Huerta against the war, but it was not put on TV, so it's like we were not there. So we marched in, and that message about the deaths, we marched with a casket right in the middle of the barrio. Instead of going to downtown, to the federal building, we went right in the middle of the barrio. We had a painting of a dead Chicano soldier. That was the first demonstration. Gloria and other women, she'll tell a little probably about it. And another one wore black in mourning with crosses and the names of Chicanos that had died in Vietnam. The message, we're dying. So we found creative ways of letting the community know that we were being kind of chumped in this war. And we shared that. So a little bit of that grew in how we could effectively do that. But it starts with communicating and sharing what you know and learning from others so that you can share it with others. Organizing.
I could say that take an issue, one issue, start with one issue, and from there start recruiting people who have that same interest, and that's your organization foundation, and then spread the word. And it takes work. It takes work to organize. It's not easy, because even within your own group core, you'll have dissension. Okay, because everybody, there might be people who might think that they know more than what you are saying or what you're trying to do. They may want a different way. And you just and that's where your communications come in. You have to learn how to talk to each other. You have to learn how to put it on the table and brainstorm and come up with the best solutions.
Yo tengo un hermanito y no sé cómo explicarle su historia de donde todo lo que nuestros hermanos, hermanas hemos pasado y no sé a qué edad sea apropiado empezar a decirle porque sé desafortunadamente en la escuela no dan mucha información sobre esto. Así es que a mí me gustaría haber aprendido esto en la prepa o en la secundaria, saber de dónde vengo, mi familia, lo que ha pasado aquí. ¿Cómo qué edad ustedes dirían que sea apropiado empezar a hablar de eso?
Okay, let me try to translate. How did we find the ability to ask about our roots and our history? No. Am I capturing all that? No, help me.
The question is, how do you tell, like, your younger brother or sister about, who doesn't know about all the things that our people have gone through in the past, our parents or the people in the neighborhood or 100 years ago or 500 years ago? What age do you begin to educate them? And well, the minute they ask a question, or you see something that's wrong in life, then you explain some of it. And if there are some things, so many of us, it wasn't until later in our lives that we began to realize the racism that we had to deal with. Sometimes it was in your face, some people. I was in an educated family that was middle class. And so sometimes people knew that I was smart or whatever, and they wouldn't put pressure on me. So I didn't quite know it until I figured out, hey, they're putting me in all these classes. There's no other Mexicans. I'm being robbed by the separation, the segregation of Mexicans. I happened to get past it, but then I didn't get to know people in the barrios after they started putting me in those classes. So that was one way it affected me. But there's so many different ways that it does. And then people will ask something, you see something happen, and then ask them.
I think that our young people, including even our little chamaquitos, can handle the truth even much more than we think. Again, like Rosario says, if they're asking the question, they need an honest answer. They need honest answers, because you know their exposure now is to everything. And if we don't interpret it, then the media and the powers that be that do try to consciously or unconsciously keep our young people down will interpret it and falsify their consciousness.
And for me, I find that culture should be taught at a very young age. Be proud of who you are. Don't let nobody put you down. Don't let nobody tell you you're not what you are. Don't try to fit in shoes that don't belong to you, basically. Your culture is your basis. It's here. It's here. And I believe in genetic memory. And that's one way to allow young people to ask questions, you know, because they're proud. So why is this happening? Why are those people fighting on the TV? Why are they shooting people? Why are people saying, hands up? Those kinds of questions. And I think honesty is the best thing, because that's reality. So don't be afraid to tell the truth. Expose young people to as much culture as possible. I just find culture is very important. I have grandchildren now. My two sons are in their 30s and 40s. And I have a two-year-old and a six-year-old grandchildren. And I expose them to culture. I read them stories about culture. I tell them songs. I tell them stories. I explain the dolphin. I explain the sun and the stars. You know, that's all things that are important to me. You know, it may not be to anybody else, but I'm speaking for myself right now. So,
Gloria, maybe you could share what you're active in now these days, so they know a little bit.
Well, I returned to my indigenous roots, which is I am a Tongva elder. And the Tongva were the First Nation people of the Los Angeles Basin for the Channel Islands. And so after the moratorium, I kind of dropped out of sight. I was so traumatized by death and things that went on with the moratorium. So I went back to went back to school as a mature student, had my sons, and then they started asking questions. You say we're Indian, but what does that mean? So I went back and, you know, did 30 years of genealogy, contacted the tribe, you know, found my lineages, my family lines, and so that's where I went. And it's Rosalio that pulled me back to the Chicano Moratorium Commemorative. So, you know, that's a whole other story. But I am basically a Native American, you know. I was taught by my dad I was a Chicano. And I used to come home crying because he would say, you're a Chicano. And I said, no, Dad, they told me I'm American in school. I was being brainwashed, okay? And no, you're a Chicano. And I would, no, Dad, I'm American. And my mom would say, when I got older, don't say you're an Indian, you are Mexican. So, you know, I had a lot of misinformation given to me as a child because my mom was punished for being Indian. That's what they did to the Los Angeles Indians. They actually sold us as slaves after the missions were secularized. And so that identity is so important to me now. Now I realize, you know, don't tell your children what they're not. You know, tell them what they are, your grandchildren. So,
beautiful. Mm-hmm. I don't think so. You need an age to start it. Any age is good to student to start to get organized. A few weeks ago, I was called by a teacher in some of the schools in the valley, and she asked me if I can go and talk to the children about our movements. I said, well, okay. I don't ask him how age they have. Okay, well, I find it. I answer what I can, and I don't, what I don't know. So I went, and I find out there was a little kids, third grade in the kinder, or something like that. Mm-hmm. Sitting down in the carpet, one of the kids say, I told my mom, and my mom called the teacher, and what is why we invite you. A little kid. So my mom took me to the Cesar Chavez Merchant, and I find out, but I want to know who he was. Well, I started telling what happened to Cesar Chavez, a little by little. I don't going to make too long. But the kids, you get surprised what was the questions they did to me. One of the questions is, why the rancheros hit pay more to the workers that work so hard? Hmm? My answer right away is, oh, porque son miserables, nomás quieren para ellos, no para los demás. But no, yes. Oh, well, because we don't ask them, we don't get organized, and okay, everything I say. Then later on, they organized the teacher. They made the teacher to make a picture and a form, a frame, with the teacher, the kids, and myself. And they did little hearts, and in each heart, they put their names. And they bring them to me. Mm-hmm. So that kids get organized. You know what I say? Yeah, that's true. I say, okay, kids, select three kids because we're going to send this picture to the Cesar Chavez wife in memory of her husband because that lady did a lot of work raising the children, helping her husband, and take care of herself. So you know they have a lot of children. So the kids are so enthusiastic, and what they going now? They select the kids, and now they are pushing me when I take the kids to see Helen Chavez. And they find out who was Helen, who was Cesar Chavez, and then started asking the questions for the immigrants, and so many of them, they need papers. So I just said, okay, we have next step, we're going to work in favor of the immigrants. And the kids can get organized, father and mother and all the family. So no matter what age we can do, we started. But try to find out the truth and do something for it.
More questions.
Good yes. Question.
¿En inglés o en español?
Lo que quieras.
Bueno, mi pregunta es, ¿qué para ustedes les parece más urgente, más necesario? ¿Un movimiento chicano o estudios chicanos?
Let me stop there. What is more urgent or necessary in our view? Chicano movement or Chicano studies?
Y también un poco pensando en el momento actual, ¿no? Porque en los 70s no había muchos, o sea, apenas estaba naciendo el movimiento chicano. Los estudios chicanos apenas estaban naciendo. Entonces, ¿Qué tanto afecta que nos concentremos más en los estudios chicanos en vez de hacer movimiento?
Mm-hmm. So now, in current times, what's more important, that we focus on Chicano studies or actual Chicano movement affecting conditions today? Rosa, you want to take that one on? Pass the hot potato.
Well, if it weren't for the movement, there'd be no Chicano studies. And if there is no movement, Chicano studies will go away. But I think that we have to take Chicano studies out into the community. So one of the ways we do it is we come into the campuses and tell you a little bit our history. I think we should do a little bit of that today too. I do a lot of commemorating now. And if you see me on, go to Rosalio Urias Munoz on Facebook, and you'll see all kinds of Chicano history, of the moratoriums, of the fight against, of Bert Corona, of the unions that Catarina is organizing, about the Tongva people, about other peoples, because we need to take our history out to the community. Sometimes it gets lost in cacademia. I learned that term from Jorge. about 20 years ago. But you do your oral histories, and then somebody gathers them up, and then maybe some scholars go look at the finders list and read a little bit about it, and then they write an article, and then somebody puts it in a textbook a few years later, et cetera, et cetera. Then it was taught in a Chicano studies class. And then the people that were taking that Chicano studies eventually graduate as a lawyer or a teacher, and then they apply it some of it into the community maybe 15, 20 years later. And so let's try and short circuit that. Let's try and keep our generations closer together and tell the stories. Like in among the Tongva, Gloria as a grandmother is an honored person who can tell the stories, who can carry the culture, and let's not try to be that separated. That's how I see that. So it's in the movement first, and they didn't have any Chicano studies when we did that, but we did have organization, like Chole says. And so in the UMAS, United Mexican American Students, I ran into Juan Gomez Quiñones and other people that started saying, read Kerry McWilliams, or look at the La Follette hearings on the breaking up of the unions, or do this and do that. And we didn't have classes, but we learned. Or let's go do this anti-police brutality thing and see what happens. And so then the study and those mixed together good. But it wasn't, if it weren't for the movement, we wouldn't have got into any of that. So it's good to be a little bit in action, even when you're on the campus. I know you're kind of far away, but that helps a lot.
Mm-hmm. You need both.
And just once again, there's a dialectic between the two. They're all part of the whole. And the years that you spend here preparing yourself to play a role in terms of the community, whatever role you decide to play, are very important. I know it can feel very isolated as someone who dropped out of college after three semesters. And I didn't regret it because I had something to go to. We were very organized in the movement in 1971. This is not 1971. So it's not as if there's something there waiting and needing you to, you know, that you have to feel guilty about being on a beautiful and important campus where you can prepare yourself, keeping your raíces active with the community to then go back to the community. Absolutely. We want you to be here. But in the long term, of course, we need both.
I believe and I know when you get to be my age, all the things you have done in organization and the classes that you've had, they're always a part of you. They'll always be with you. We were talking about, you know, the things that we did in the 60s helped me to be who I am today. So always remember that. It's always a part of you, no matter what you do in terms of organization, the Chicano Studies classes that you're taking, they're always a part of you. And then you'll share them with others.
Como dijimos, necesitan las dos cosas. Y si ustedes empiezan a investigar cómo empezó Pumas y cómo se organizó Mecha, y son cosas que los mismos estudiantes pueden ir creando. Yo recuerdo los estudiantes escribiendo en una mesa, le ponemos Mexican, bueno, M, E, por Mexican American, ustedes estudian lo que fuera. Y entonces, no, pero dice Mecha, van a creer que somos cerillos. Y así duraban horas buscando la cosa correcta para que se organizara. Por fin dijeron, bueno, pues, como dijo el señor Corona, que fue nuestro, como dicen, héroe, porque él también, César Chávez le llamó maestro, porque él le ayudó mucho a César, inclusive a conquistarse. Un día los campesinos se morían de hambre, necesitan ustedes saber un poquito de esto, para que sepan cómo se organizan. Estaban los campesinos ya muriéndose en hambre porque salieron en huelga. Y César llamó al señor Corona y fuimos a verlo porque iba yo con él. Casi íbamos a ver porque las señoras entendían conmigo y los señores con el señor Corona. So, entonces, llegamos y él dijo César, ¡bruh! Viejo, le decía, viejo, maestro, ya no tenemos dinero. Entonces, necesitamos comida. Dijo, ok, está bien, dijo el señor Corona. Pónganse una mesita, aquí tienen un mantelito, sí. ¿Tienen una virgencita? Sí, yo tengo una virgen de Guadalupe, dijo una señora, tráetela. Se trajo la virgen de Guadalupe, pusieron la mesita y puso el señor Corona un plato. Por favor, ponga aquí su donación. Se llenó el plato. No tienen idea. Toda la gente dejó su colaboración. Por poquitos puntos se hacen muchos. Pero si ustedes encuentran cómo se formó Mecha, cómo se formó la organización estudiantil y todo. Cuando yo vine a Estados Unidos, eran pocos los latinos que podían entrar a la universidad. A las unidades altas, solo los que tenían harto dinero, como el West Point y esas cosas, ¿no? Ni soñarlo, ¿verdad? Pero ¿cómo empezaron a atender y a recibir todas las demás gentes. Se organiza la gente. En el correo no nos recibían ni las cartas de nuestra organización al principio. Y se vieron obligados a hacerlo cuando vieron que estábamos organizados. Júntense y háganlo. Otra necesitan
cosa,
las dos.
Another thing I wanted to add. Oh, another thing I wanted to add is that not just Chicano studies or indigenous studies. Study the world, study the people. We're also indigenous of the planet. And I think that ignorance, somewhat isolation, the Western Hemisphere being relatively isolated by big oceans, or California, Los Angeles, being isolated by oceans, high deserts, forests, and all of this, that they didn't get all that much communication. The Aztecs, they didn't know the maritime, how to cross the ocean and navigate. They didn't know where the Europeans were coming from, and they were able to be divided and conquered because we didn't know about them what they knew about us in that sense. And then the science or other things, there's positive parts of it, so that we have to be aware. And right now, the whole planet is at stake. It's a more serious thing. Maybe it was very serious back then in the 70s, but we weren't so much aware. We're just beginning to get aware, and we're seeing it. So I want to say all of those kind of studies and engagement is necessary. Like, I remember when UMA started, and I came from a middle-class family. My dad had gotten a PhD. They had a struggle and faced discrimination. They didn't tell me about it. I found out later. And my mom, and so I said, oh, I'm going to this meeting. My Spanish isn't that good. You know, I'm not, you know, I wasn't in a gang or I wasn't in this. You know, I knew a little bit. My relatives or friends or some of the So what can I contribute? Well, then it's a long story, but basically they sent one of the big their leaders and said, well, you're on the student council, and we need money to get Bert Corona and Cesar Chavez and Reyes Tijerina and all of them, and so I could help doing that. And then I listened to them, and I said, wow. You know, Tijerina, who just died, he started speaking in Spanish, and all these people that I knew and had in classes and in organizations, girls that I dated, and they were lost. And I said, that's not right. But then he went, I forgot that he'd already talked in English. And he told the story of the bird, that, you know, the bird, you can take him out of the jaula, out of the cage, and free him. But if you cut his wings, he can't fly. And our language is that. And I said, yeah, well, that's right. We have to have the right. People have to learn to speak Spanish, starting with me, and those kinds of things.
Other questions?
Yeah, so I'm actually from East LA myself.
What part?
I'm from Boyle Heights.
Orale, pues.
Yeah, so I'm originally from Pico Union. Definitely a gentrified place, and because of like the renovations, like my family had to move out because we couldn't afford the rent. So now we live in government housing in Boyle Heights, and like we ran away from gentrification once, and now in Boyle Heights, right now is that threat of gentrification again. And Little Tokyo downtown, it's almost like a web that's like getting closer, and like the people in the community are fighting against it. And, like, I'm all for it, but my question is, like, what kind of strategies can still be created, like, for our communities, like, the Latino communities, like, the Black communities, the white communities, like, how the Asian communities, like, how can there be, like, a better cultural understanding? Because you were just talking about how, like, isolation is bad, and, like, I almost see that, like, amongst the youth in my community, that they're just so isolated from Black from, like, Asian people that they don't even know, like, they're not even so familiar with their own culture. So, like, menos with, like, other cultures. And it's kind of sad because, like, yeah, we're striving to, like, keep our own, like, community, like, not allowing almost other cultures to come in. But it's almost, like, isolating. So, like, what strategies can be built to embrace the Chicano identity while, like, recognizing that there are other cultures?
Mm-hmm. So the question is fairly complex, but the bottom line is what strategies can be built to honor our own cultures at the same time embrace and welcome and unite with other cultures of people, oppressed people or working people, in the context and in the face of gentrification in our city, specifically in Los Angeles. Okay, who would like to go first on that one? Charlie?
Bueno, si quieren, un poquito. No soy la que sabe todo, pero un poquito sí les puedo dar mi experiencia. Aquí mismo en Los Ángeles hay un lugar que es duro entre la comunidad negra y la comunidad hispana. Y me invitaron para darles clases igual que en otra en Nueva York, donde la gente no se podía ver Bronx con Manhattan. Ustedes saben, hay diferentes culturas y diferentes judíos, etcétera, etcétera, negros y todo. Y allá también se formó porque se mataban terriblemente todos. ¿Cómo hacemos para qué tienen, qué pasa? Pues me dijeron, primero fui a Nueva York a ver qué pasaba allá con la iglesia episcopal. Entonces, dice, no sabemos qué hacer, dijo el obispo de los episcopales allá. Tenemos dinero, pero no sabemos en qué emplearlo. Dije, pues en la gente, pues ¿qué lo puedes emplear? Bueno, total que no sabían cómo empezar la unidad con la gente. Y a mí no se me hizo difícil porque me gusta platicar. Pero, ¿todos están entendiendo en español?
Sí.
¿O quieren que se los diga en inglés? Me costaría más. Bueno.
Get a personal translator.
Un translator, sí. Ok. Pero sigo. Bueno, entonces dije, por primera estaba viviendo en Manhattan. Y la situación estaba por allá en otro barrio, en Bronx. Todo el mundo me dijo, no te metas a Bronx, porque ahí no quieren a los latinos. Cuidado, los negros te matan. Y que no vayas y que esto y que el otro. Yo hablé con el padre Luz, que en paz descanse también, otro luchador grande. Rosalío sabe muy bien quién es él. ¿Quién fue él? Entonces, me dice, vente, ¿sabes cómo venirte? Toma el tren, ya me dijo que en la estación, pues, todo tuve que aprender. Irme como irme y bájate en tal parte y luego caminas 2 cuadras y está la iglesia donde tienes que encontrarme. Pues hice todo lo que me dijo y ya me bajé. Pero todo el mundo me decía, no te vayas a Bronx, no te vayas a Bronx, porque está muy feo. Pues cuando yo me bajé ahí, dije yo, ya voy allá y ahí voy. Mucha gente muy amable. Puestos por todos lados, naranjas, manzanas, ropa, calcetines, camisetas, todo por ahí, un puesto de un lado, de otro lado, toda la gente muy sonriente conmigo, y yo caminé como reina de pared. Good morning, hi, how are you? Y que la gente, hi, y que saludándome todo el mundo, llegué a la iglesia y le dije, oiga padre, pues ¿dónde es Bronx? Pues aquí es Bronx. Digo, pero aquí la gente no se mira mala. Y me dice, le dije, todo el mundo me saludó, yo también saludé. Y todo dice, qué bueno, y él se rió. Dice, así que no encontraste gente mala, pues yo no la encontré. Digo, ¿por qué? ¿Por qué dice toda la gente que son así? Dice, porque no se conocen. Cuando se conocen, se les quita el miedo. Y yo vine y le pasé ese mensaje a otro sacerdote donde íbamos a dar las clases de inglés para la ciudadanía. Le hagan algo, una fiesta y todo. ¿Saben qué ha pasado? Que hoy se llevan mejor porque los mexicanos o los latinos invitaron al desfile de 5 de mayo a todos los de otras razas de allí y les pidieron que llevaran un cortejo en la marcha que iban a tener su nombre. Ahora se conocen un poco mejor. Y ahí van, empezando. Hay que buscar la manera de cómo llegarles a los demás. Por ejemplo, en Bronx, lo que hicimos fue una piñata. Una piñata al público. Y le pusimos es otro detalle de allá en Nueva York. Les pusimos frutas, dulces, penis y unas tarjetas que fueron las primeras que hicimos, que decían, conozca sus derechos. Y fíjense la generosidad de ese señor Corona. Él se hizo notario y les pedía su identificación a la gente para firmarle su identificación como notario, asegurando que era una cosa verdadera, para que se pudieran identificar, para que no los agarrara la policía. Bueno, todo eso se ha hecho, mucho trabajo, es trabajo, pero sirve, a la larga sirve mucho. Y yo creo que si ustedes buscan un método, por ejemplo, esas piñatas que nosotros hicimos en Nueva York, cuando se rompió la piñata y llevaron los papelitos a la... Muchos, pues, ni caso les hacían, ¿verdad? Pero un recuerdo que yo tengo muy personal mío, que me dejó mucho de satisfacción, fue que un niño le llevó a un señor ya grande una tarjeta de esas y le dice, abuelito, abuelito, y se la dio. Mucha gente puertorriqueña o de Santo Domingo, de Haití, le dio la tarjeta. Y vino el señor conmigo, no les miento, se arrodilló y me besó la mano. Dice, si yo he sabido y he tenido este conocimiento hace años, cuando era joven, no hubiera pasado toda mi vida en la cárcel por no saber mis derechos. ¿Mm? Así que por algo se puede empezar, hacer una fiesta, una piñata o lo que sea, pero convivir, un desfile, una conmemoración, cualquier cosa.
You know, one of the things on... I dealt with the issue. In our time, it was wasn't gentrification. It was urban renewal, people removal for Dodger Stadium, for the freeways, for all of this. And we organized, and we found common interest with white neighborhoods and other neighborhoods, Chinese neighborhoods on the east side. You know, with Echo Park, with Eagle Rock, and all of those. That's back and after the moratorium, because we needed to have stability. The deportations was one part of instability. Being moved out of your neighborhoods was part of instability. On gentrification, well, I think part of the issue is what are the common economic issues or even class or strata issues that can unite people? Like for me, I say, how do we fight gentrification? I say we fight it with gentification, empowering people. And basic things are economic. For gente vacation, you need to raise the wages and lower the rents. And because that's going to give people more ability to deal with those kinds of things. I have different ideas about it. I don't know if we want to get specific. But you have to find those common interests that unite you with other people. And the fact that we have elites that are, you know... More and more, you know, the differences are growing between the rich and the poor and all of that kind of thing. And the middle is disappearing. So we need to find that. I think the union fight is a very important fight. Try to get that support in things. But we have to look at those common interests because it's in struggle where people begin to understand each other. Another example, I remember when I was starting to recruit people, and a guy was saying, how do I get the students in this particular Pioneer High School to speak English? He said, well, get a blonde girlfriend. You'll start speaking. And then how do you teach politics? Well, try to meet their father, and you'll find out about politics. But anyway, but it's just some of the common interests, you know, that you have. It's a big problem. You know, the Gold Line has brought... all kinds of problems about because more money gets invested, whether it's in Boyle Heights or Highland Park or around Lincoln Heights, you know, and it brings in, it's more geared towards Pasadena and maybe, you know, those kinds of things. And you have to look at those kind of things as well. But anyway, there's ways of dealing with that, the transportation agency, all their money, and why don't they put that money into more low-cost housing and all those kinds of things, because it's getting harder and harder for people to live in the city of LA, you know, for Mexican blacks, low income, and
more questions. Another hand, yes, back there.
So first of all, let me say it's really an honor to be here, and I've studied and read and learned so much from the people sitting in the front of the room, but it's great to listen to these stories. And I'm going to try to narrow my 150 questions down to one, which is, you know, something that was said was this idea of how Chicano studies. By the way, I'm a professor of Chicano studies at San Diego City College, and one of the things that was said was that if we don't have movements, we don't have Chicano studies. And I just want to say that that's our life. That's what we live with, is that we're constantly under attack. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways that we survive is we organize and we connect with our communities, and our students, right, have a natural, obviously, connection to their communities, and we bring those struggles into the classroom, right? And that's one of the vibrant aspects of Chicano studies, is because it was born that way, right? It didn't, you know, develop that, it was born that way. But leading to my question, you know, for me to begin to develop a Chicano identity, I needed access to hear the stories, and I needed to learn from the participants. You know, we have this, our own intellectual traditions, right? Not only the writings, but the stories of the people, like ustedes, the things that you did. But it's almost, it's all predicated on a radical critique of the society that we live in. And so when you said, when you mentioned, Rosalio, that, you know, one of the first political, you know, when you were undergoing that sort of organizational process, somebody mentioned Kerry McWilliams, or, you know, read this or that or the other, that intellectual formation is so important. And that's one of the reasons why I think Chicano studies is so marginalized, is because it's based on this intellectual tradition of critique, you know, radical critique and organization. And so that's a hard thing to communicate, because when you're teaching, you know, you're teaching history, you're teaching whatever it is, but you're also trying to, you know, concientización, you're also trying to raise consciousness, and you're trying to instill in people a sense of that intellectual tradition of struggle, but also the urgency of it, and it's a challenge. So it would help me to understand that and how to communicate that more effectively, if I could hear from you, Paul, what were those processes that led you to develop that radical critique? What, not just the experience, obviously that's important for opening that space, but, you know, what new sort of ideas or old ideas did you begin to draw from, you know, and in order to begin to empower yourself to become that?
Okay, so I'll try to summarize the question. What were our individual experiences of personal concientización into a radical critique of all the political economy of our environment that allowed us to grow and develop based on our experience in the Chicano movement? Does that capture it? Okay, cool. Anybody want to start out? Well, I'm going to start, because I remember the very moment when I realized that I could be both an activist Chicana and a Marxist who was striving for complete, fundamental, and total revolutionary change in the society. And that was at the Chicano Youth Conference in Denver, Colorado, where Rosalio started the movement for the August 29th Chicano Moratorium Against the War. I had in school, I knew that there was Marxism, and I was very attracted to it, radical change, but I only heard white people talking about it. And I also heard, of course, you know, and was very active in Mecha and the Chicano movement, that such as it was at my school. And I felt split. So I remember when someone told me, you know, we can do both. We can do both. And that really changed my life, because then I went on to do both. And ever since then, even though the left organization I was involved in fell apart and I moved into the labor movement to effect change, I still have my same radical political critique and understanding of the world, and that's informed my work in my union for 38 years now. So, yeah, it's very, very important.
Having come from, I guess, one of the most radical organizations, Brown Berets, I have to look at my my teen years, even as a child. I live in El Monte, the same house that my parents lived in, and they're both gone. I raised my two children there. But at one time, it was predominantly a white community, very racist. I never understood why. My mom told me, she was Native American, so she was dark-skinned, dark-haired. My dad was very light-skinned, hazel eyes, brown hair. And he got a house with his GI benefits. The last day he bought my mother in, and they tried to take the house away and say, we're sorry, we have to cancel this. And my father went into a rage and said, you think I'm stupid? You know, you've got my money, I've signed, now my wife signs. I found out just this year, or last year, there was a law in El Monte that you could not sell homes to Mexicans. It was a law. And so that was why the realtors did what they did. But growing up, you know, I felt the racism. I remember my mother taking me to a Thrifty's counter. Probably none of you remember too much about Thrifty counters, but they did serve food in the Thrifty stores. And there was three very large white women who, because of their behavior, were very ugly to me, very scary. And you feel your parents' fear, because she right away embraced me. And she said, oh, honey, let's go sit over here. And they were scowling at my mother, like saying, don't you dare sit over here. You know, black people go through this, went through this, you know. But we also went through it. And in high school, El Monte Union High School, we had race riots. And it was white versus Chicanos. And the law enforcement would come in on their motorcycles in the hallways of the school and arrest only the Chicanos. So, you know, that's what I grew up with. So being radical, even though I was found, I was invited to go to La Piraña Coffee House, which was not yet the Brown Beret organization, but that was where they were at. And I was cruising Whittier Boulevard. Okay, that's what we did. And we went down there. And everything they said was so radical and so different to me. And they said, would you like to join? And I said, let me think about it. And I kept going back. I wanted more information, more information. And then, you know, it started making sense to me. And so for me, based on what I went through as a child, prepped me to be militant and radical.
Don't get scared when they say they are very radical. When we started, we are communists. We are everything they like it. So they call us names, especially to us. They have people. I believe they was my friends and even the family. But what are you doing close to Bill Corona? He's a communist. I said, well, If the communist is what he is doing, oh my God, but what are we doing on the other side? I never saw these people that called my attention I was doing with the communists. I never saw it doing what Mr. Corona was doing. Sometimes he took food to the people that don't have nothing to eat. He registered kids in the school. He put direct the kids to get to the universities. He pushed the guys to play in the politicians. And he's doing something that was justice for todo un pueblo. So no los dejen que se asusten. Y él no era comunista. Ni le importaba uno el otro. Lo que le importaba mucho era la justicia. Si ustedes creen que el lado de la justicia es por donde ustedes van, you're great. So don't get nobody to scare you. The father in the church I was attending that times, many people let me have meetings in the hall of the church. So he knows what I was doing. And the people was crying to him, Father, what do I do? My son, que the work, que lo despidieron, que I lost my job, things like that. You see, He said, well, go with Chole. She tells us what you have to do it. I said, don't come in and cry and be under, now was del padre, no se escondan en la nagua del sacerdote para llorar sus penas. Vayan a que las organice y las lleve a donde deben de ir. Y no era un comunista, ni era una mala gente. Él tenía unas ideas muy abiertas, very open mind. Pero siempre yo creo que estaba por la juventud y la justicia. So, no los dejen asustarlos, que son radicales, que son esto, que son lo otro. Son lo que son y luchan por la justicia. Ahí está el fin.
I think some of the urge to struggle, or it's just part of human life, but come from many different kinds of institutions. I think Chole could tell you about her father in the railroad union, and how he taught her union history in Mexico. And then she came here and linked up eventually with Bert Corona and others and did things. I got some of mine from the church. You know, Mexico has had a lot of different things with the Catholic Church. And my grandfather was a Methodist minister, so he ran into a lot of problems. And in the Protestant traditions from Mexico, it's not the majority, but they don't talk about it. But part of the Protestant message was learn to read. Read the Bible on your own and don't trust the priest. So my dad got a PhD. My four aunts were teachers after they came over here from Mexico. And then there were the stories of the discrimination and all of these things. And so that the people should be able to develop their own relationship with God, let's say. But that also has some not totally critical and all of that kind of thing. But that is a critique. So there are different institutions that we get that critique. And it isn't just Carrie McWilliams. I had that's a good history. But there's so much more in the history, like Gloria. In her neighborhood, I know they're preparing themselves and teaching themselves the culture of their neighborhood. Maybe you could they may get gentrification later on. Right now, but they have their own oral history. Maybe you could say a little bit about why and how that happens.
I was recently last year contacted by some of the young people that live in El Monte. And still in East Los Angeles. I'm kind of based in El Monte now. I'm not in East LA anymore. And there's organizations called East of East. So El Monte is east of Los Angeles. So we're East of East. There's an art posse that is trying to discover all the history in El Monte. And I've been reading amazing articles that students are writing essays on. I think I've been contacted by three different students to write an essay about the Chicano movement and what I was involved in. So they feel, you know, even though I did all that in East Los Angeles, I am from El Monte, you know. And that was something I wasn't really, really proud of, you know. But now I'm learning all this wonderful history. There was a lynching of Juana Maria. There was, I forget the name, they were a white vigilante group, and they were killing Mexicans, okay? There was some brothers that were there that I had never heard about, and I'm learning all these new things. We had we considered them barrios, Hicks Camp and Hayes Camp. They're writing these wonderful stories, you know. Jorge today pointed out, you know, we have these leaders and people want to say the bad things. And I'm guilty of doing that about people sometimes, you know, just instead of saying, here's all the wonderful things this person did. So I'm kind of learning that about El Monte. So it's very interesting. And young people are getting involved, and that's a good thing.
Hi, my name is Monica Hernandez, mucho gusto. My question is more towards the women. I don't mean to exclude, but as women, were you conscious of your position as women? Were you ever treated as second class because you were women? I know we study about Chicano feminism and this idea of women being considered as sellouts to their culture. Did you ever experience that, and how did you combat that? What advice do you have for Chicanas nowadays to combat any aggressions we might get as women as well?
Okay, so the question is, how did we, what was our experience as women in the Chicano movement? What were our particular challenges? Were there pressures on us, et cetera? You want to start, Gloria or Tony?
I do. I have a big story to tell. No. In the Brown Berets, we truly believed we were side by side. In reality, we weren't. I donated everything that I had collected over the years. Pictures, newspapers, buttons, my beret, posters. I donated, I didn't donate it. I gifted it to
Cal State LA.
And it's a special collection. It's, they say if they were to put it out, it would measure a mile long. And so I just went, it's been there maybe about 3 years, I would think. And I just barely went this last Tuesday with an ex-Brown Beret that I had not seen in over 50 years. And we went through the photos, and we had the best time just reliving all these memories. And it's also the most used collection. People go and can get copies of the photos and everything else. And it's just... It was so such a good feeling to go there with somebody who could tell me some of the stories that I didn't know. And I thought I knew everything, you know. And in the Brown Berets, now I'm going to go back to the Berets. It was very hard being a female. You know, we learned the hard way that we weren't equal to the men, even though we always said that, that we were revolutionary sisters and brothers. It wasn't true. And there was many abuses. And these stories have come out in interviews. And there was even... I'll speak for myself. I almost felt I was raped twice, almost, you know. One time, I was prepared to protect myself. I had a bottle in my car, and I was going to stab that person. But there was another person with that person who said, you know, you don't want to do that. He wanted me to get out of the car, and I knew I was in an area where I would be trapped. And I'm a big woman. I always use my size to intimidate people. My voice was very loud. It's gotten very soft lately, you know, but I guess I always used my personal power to, you know, not let people mess with me, especially men. And I just found in the Berets, you know, I was very dedicated. I worked so hard. The women worked so hard, but we were never acknowledged. And it wasn't until recently that I was acknowledged and the women were acknowledged. But I also learned in retrospect that a lot of the women were being abused. One was even slapped. And I did not know those things, and it made me feel bad. It made me feel like I didn't do my job, as I was the only female minister nationally. Okay, my title was Minister of Finance and Communications and Finance. All I was a glorified secretary. That's the reality of it. And we did the newspaper. We did all the correspondence. We did so many jobs. We ran the free clinic. And when I started having problems with a lot of the men, they would use the clinic to party in after it was closed. Well, we were the janitors. So I kept complaining to the head of the Brown Berets and told him, you've got to straighten these guys up. He wasn't able to do that. So it came down to, if you can't straighten them up, then we walk. I'll take all the women. I'll take some of your men. I did that, okay? And we did it collectively. I can't say I did it. But I learned in those days, if you were feminist, you were a white woman's liver, okay? You were burning your bra, okay? So I couldn't identify with that, you know? And but 40 years, 45 years later, because I left the whole Chicano movement. I look back with the help of Rosalio that I was denying my own personal history. I am a feminist. I was a feminist. You know, just didn't know and just didn't understand it, really. Because we were trying so much to be, you know, with the men equal. And
you know, a lot of the things that they did for me being a minister, they would say, were you involved? People ask me, did you get involved with that? No, I was never asked to go to those meetings. Plus, I was very, very large. I mean large. I'm very tall, big bone, tall. I didn't want to be in the front because people ridicule you all the time because of what you look like. They're not looking at what's in your heart and what's in your mind and what your words are. And I had to personally learn how to say, you don't like me? I don't care. This is me. You don't want to hear what I have to say? I don't care. There are people that want to hear what I have to say. So as a woman, it was always a struggle. You know, I'm going to tell you a funny story. We got Army Reserves to give us a tank for the September 16th parade. So our plan was, okay, we don't wear our berets or our bush jackets until we're on the tank. You wear a reboso to cover it up. And so as we went down this parade route, okay, we're next marching next to LAPD, and we're getting the ugliest looks. And, you know, we're yelling all down the street, Chicano para viva la raza, and all this stuff. And then the people who were lined watching the parade started yelling because the majority of us, I would say, were very overweight. My brother was on that tank. He was overweight. A lot of the women were overweight. And they started yelling, Viva las gordas! And I felt myself doing this shrinking, you know, going down like this. Oh, the one thing I didn't want to be seeing, you know, these people were yelling. But at the end of that parade route, there was no more tank left because people were jumping on it from the movement. All you could see was a cannon. So we had good times and we had bad times. Some of the pictures that me and my friend were looking at last week that are in my collection was a Brown Beret conference. Okay, all these different chapters from California came in. And there was a woman taking notes, secretary, okay? I know I was out there hanging out in the front. But I told him, of all the pictures here, where are the women? He goes, oh, there are no women there. And I go, I want you to see this one picture. So there's a picture of women who are happy, but they're cooking. Okay, they have their beret on. And I go, this is where the women were. This is what happened all the time. So, I mean, that's my experience just from that, and that's what made me leave. Part of that is why I left the Brown Berets, you know, because we were not acknowledged. We were not really treated with respect. And I think from all the documents that I have read, or not documents, what people have written, blame the breakup of the Brown Berets because of the disrespect to the women. You know, so history had a way of acknowledging that, and that's the way it is. You know, so.
Yes, Jorge. Jorge, you have another issue. Okay, go on.
I, yes, going to give you something. The woman's progress, if they don't permit nobody, miss the respect. Si ustedes no pierden el respeto, vamos a ir adelante. Pero until now, hasta ahora, todavía, las pobres mujeres están aniquiladas. Allá tú y yo acá. En muchos casos. Pero los hombres han aprendido mucho. Mucho también. Ahora ya se pueden poner a cocinar junto con las mujeres. Ok, tú frís los frijoles y yo los voy a servir. Más fácil, ¿verdad? Y ir poco a poco desenmascarando lo que en realidad nos estorba, que no haya una igualdad. Entonces, una muchacha, llévatela, sobre todo ahorita, que hay tanta mezcolancia de todo. Las drogas, antes, por ejemplo, era la virginidad de la mujer y la respetaban. En aquellos tiempos había más respeto. Ahora, las mismas mamás han enseñado a irles a comprar los condones a las muchachas. Y órale, ya tienes tu primera vez, pero la segunda ya la llevó con quién sabe cuál. Y ya la arrastraron y ahora llora. Pero ya no hay remedio, ya no hay respeto. Lo que tenemos que ver también, que deben de respetar a las mujeres desde que están en la escuela. Por eso han abusado tanto de todas y de tantas. La droga es otra cosa. Es el negocio de los grandes. Dicen por eso que así empezaron los primeros que vinieron a conquistar, que vinieron a invadir América, a establecer sus leyes. Dales vino, emborráchalos, tenlos enajenados, a todo mundo, es de nosotros. Tenemos que empezar otra vez a detener tantito, tanta riqueza de esos tipos para destruir nuestras comunidades. No lo merecemos. Eso es todo.
I wanted to talk. Yeah, there was very much, it was a male thing in leadership and speaking roles and all of that, although it was changing because society was changing and we were working to change society. And so things like what Gloria did, what they did, they formed a group called Las Adelitas. Okay, so they were fighting for the people, but they were doing it in their style, not the kind of paramilitary thing, the Brown Berets style, and a more unifying role in the community. And we saw that a little bit and appreciated somewhat, but it took years. And a lot of us on the peace issue, there's no money in the peace issue. You know, it's in the military. So you don't get as much activism, but you don't get a lot of the corruption, too. So I think a lot of us on the committee were pretty principled in terms of how we dealt with women. It was part, but none of us made much money at all later on in life, if you look, or got elected to anything. I ran a couple of times, but for particular reasons. But women were the heart and soul, were the main social force in the peace movement. Men still had that hang-up of the machismo. And it was hard to get around. And the women didn't want their sons to die. They didn't want, and they didn't want it in an unjust war. And there were funny ways in all kinds of ways that had happened. In my family, I have a family that goes back a couple hundred years in Tucson, and when it was a presidio, it was just a fortress and didn't have a town. But we go back there, and I've refused induction. I got drafted on Mexican Independence Day, and so we made a big thing about opposing for the discrimination. And I started running around the country, and I had long hair and beads and a peace symbol. You remember huaraches and all of this stuff. And my grandmother was 90-some years old, and my mom said, well, we all got to go there. Well, I'm in a demonstration in San Francisco of 250,000 people, or I'm in Kansas City at a conference of all the Chicano leaders, and I'm here and I'm there, and then we go to Tucson, and I decided to have a fast, and so I was on a fast, and it's Thanksgiving, and the oldest uncle, and he was big in the Republican newspaper. He sold ads; they knew all the Mexican community. They could sell ads. And he's just jumping all over. My mom, what are you doing? Your son is doing this. He's all mechudo. He's all this and that. And he's just going and going and going. And he says, and besides, you know, his aunts have been here in this hot kitchen all day cooking the food, and he's not even going to eat it. My grandmother goes and sits in the dining room a little ahead of time and says, everybody come in here. And as I walk in the door into the dining area, she said, Rosalio, vente aquí. Siéntate aquí. Quiero ver tus ojos, te ves muy mexicano. And she settled the war issue on Vietnam in the living room there for the whole family to see. This is what we have to do. This is what I'm proud of. My uncle had to kind of go out the side door that day. He was a good man in many, many ways, but that's how my grandmother dealt with that problem. And so when I went to my first moratorium meeting, the Berets had called it, there was Hilda, and you know her with the carrieras, very attractive young woman and all that Berets. She was maybe 16 at that time, I think. But she went out and she gave a report on collecting food and money from the merchants, and it was very organized, and you know, she was very effective in getting that money. And so that was, I said, that's respectful. That's something I can work with in the community, and we can come together. So there was a coming together, but the women had a big role in that. But there still wasn't the recognition. Years later, I got blackballed by some people in the movement when we had the 20th anniversary. They didn't want... I was in the Communist Party, still am at that point. And I said, but look, I know all the people that were in the moratorium. So a young student came from Yale, and he was a Chicano, and he was doing a paper, and he chose the moratorium. I said, well, you don't just interview me. You have to interview all the different people. So he went out, and Gloria was one. He interviewed, and it came back, and I read it, and Gloria said, well, we would go, and there would be these conferences or this or that at different demonstrations in cities, and the men would be over there drinking and talking politics, and women were in the kitchen, and we'd be organizing. And I went like this. You know, I thought Gloria was a good office worker. She dealt well with people and making us, but I didn't see her as an organizer. And this is, you know, this is 1995 or something like that. And then I said, oh, my God. And then I said, I got to correct how we do those things. So I said, Gloria, that's when I started saying, hey, you got to get in this kind of thing. So that was a very real thing. And there were different levels of the discrimination that were there. But who moved it? And I wish we had. Irene Tovar was a leader. She came down with a cold, and she was just too sick to come. But she organized the Chicano Moratorium Committee in the Valley. And when Alicia Escalante was at all our demonstrations, she led the welfare rights. And the very, very strong leaders, when a lot of the guys weren't there, they were there. At the press conferences where there's a 500 police outside and outside where we're meeting, you know, they were there. So that's part of that story. But, you know, as they say, if you don't know the history of the women, you don't know the history. Mm-hmm. And so we need a lot more Chicano studies, needs a lot more Chicana studies. Mm-hmm. And I have to find myself, I start talking about the movement and I'm talking about all the guys. And I just have to say, stop. And then I have to say, the women, and what were they doing? Then I have to find out. So I had to talk to Gloria, too, and other people, so we could tell the history to the next generations better as well.
Please give a big round of applause to these guys. Let's keep the clap going.
Hey, all right.
Que viva!
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.